my first vote when I came out to San Diego, because California then had the vote. It was before the 20th Amendment was passed. That was one of the things those girls from KQED couldn't understand. They wanted to know if everybody voted when I first voted in 1916, and they'd never heard that Wyoming was the first state. They want to know why, and I told them because women were precious and valuable and pioneers, at least. Young, of course. They hardly can think of us as human beings. They're always surprised when they find something happened that they thought of.
Do you recall when you first would have used the word feminist as compared to suffragist?
I couldn't tell you. Too far back, I have no idea. Probably I found it in my voluminous reading on the subject. I remember in my grandmother's house there was a book translated into French by Michelet, who was a well-known historian of the 19th century, and I think it was called Woman. Now I can remember some of the things in it still, the patronizing, woman is a lesser man and all you. Passes masculine, moonlight under sunlight, and there's water under wine. That was the general feeling. And I can remember he talked about the special care and tenderness and consideration must be given to the pregnant woman, and he went on as a pregnancy were a very serious disease that some people were coming from. After all, in those days, at least half the children died in infancy. My grandmother was one of 15, all of whom remarkably grew up, and all but one were married and had children. My mother had 100 first cousins. 100 exactly, because her father was one of 8, and they all married and had children. But on the other hand, my grandmother herself had 8 children, of whom only 5 grew up. 3 died as children, small children. And that was the common thing. Mm-hmm. You'd meet a woman, you'd say, how many children do you have? And she'd tell you, and you'd say, how many times did you have a child? And it'd be maybe twice that many.
Yeah. Well, do you feel, from what we talked about last time and from the things that you're saying now, very young, you were aware of what it meant to be a woman. How do you think this affected your writing throughout your life?
The only thing I can say is that the KQED people made me read to them one of the stories in my collection, Xenogenesis. This is all science fiction about matrimony, reproduction, and sex, and other planets in the future. And I should say that every one of those stories is oriented toward feminism. And the women are always, and I read them from the introduction, in which I said how in the early days women never appeared in science fiction except as somebody to be captured by a bug-eyed monster and rescued or something of that sort. They were passive and acquiescent. But the particular one they had me read from was called Superior Sex, and it was distinctly, though a satirical thing, it was distinctly a feminist story. But except for that, and the fact that in my mystery stories, I have just as often had the woman an active criminal and murderer as a man, I see no distinction. I've never written the kind of thing that would particularly need to take an attitude one way or the other, or even to consider it. I did, at one time, I asked a publisher, publisher's representative here, whom I knew about doing it was about the time that Woman's Lib began. I think it was the time that Betty Friedan's book came out. And I had an idea for a book, and he was very much interested in it, but New York finally said, no, they didn't think there was enough interest, after which there was that terrible flood of them. And I was busy doing other things, so I just dropped it. So I've never... I've written a number of magazine articles. most of the magazines now extinct, like Scribner's and those, but on subjects dealing more or less with feminism. I had one on some farm journal from the Middle West on Do Women Want Children, which I said, there's no such thing as the maternal instinct. And I remember having one in some magazine and having a funk whose name I've forgotten, called Half Past 6 o'clock. I said, well, that subject, as far as I know, I've always written, where there was occasion to mention it at all, I've always written from that viewpoint. Mm-hmm. But I never wrote particularly on it. Yeah, I got very early involved in political and economic subjects.
But your early poetry, for instance, did any of that ever deal with how you felt about being a woman? Your early poetry?
Well, yes. That's another thing they had me read, too, very early. One of the girls said, is that one of your best poems? I said, no, it's one of my worst ones, so that's the subject that you want. I've written very little, but I have a few feminist poems, yes.
Of your very early ones?
Yeah, very early. Like if you want them, I'll be glad to copy them for you, but they're not particularly good poems. One of them was published, and I think one of them wasn't. There were only two I could remember from that far back.
When were those published? When would that be?
Oh, this would be back in the 19-teens. I don't remember when exactly. Sometime before 1915, I guess.
Well, I think it would be interesting if we ever can get money to do a transcript to show that as a very early work where that...
Yeah, they could almost date one or two of those things. Well, anytime you want to, just let me know and I'll send you a copy.
Oh, good.
One, I think, was called Women to Man, and the other one was about Medea. Making Medea into a heroine is quite a job. I was surprised when I came across that after all of years.
So actually, there has been a thread from your very early writing up to now in terms of...
Yeah, I can't remember when... Well, I think I told you, and I certainly told them, that I became a feminist at the age of 6. And ever since then, I was always on the side of the girl against the boy, which is probably the reason I had no boyfriends until I was in my little place.
You had a sister, didn't you?
Yes.
Was she a feminist?
Well, not actively, but she was certainly, she was very active in her union. She was director of industrial art in the Fort Lauderdale Public Schools, and she was, for years, secretary of her local union. And she served in France during World War I as what they called a reconstruction aide, teaching new crafts and to soldiers who had something wounded somehow so that they couldn't go on with their formal work. And she always was on this, had the right attitude, but I don't think she ever became very active. She never worked in the suffrage movement or anything like that. But she was 2 years younger than I, and she was still quite young when the 20th Amendment was passed.
But, for instance, when your mother sent you down to suffrage headquarters, she never said...
Well, I don't think anybody ever suggested that Alice do anything she didn't want to do. If she had asked, I think she'd have they'd have been glad to have her, but she was very busy with other things. She was always the aggressive person in our family, and I was the timid one that hung back and had to be pushing the thing.
How do you feel about the ideas of the current women's movement?
About
the current women's movement.
You mean the so-called women's mm-hmm. movement? Well, I certainly don't like some of the more extreme manifestations. I mean, they seem foolish. The ostentatious anti-man business and some of the demonstrations seem to be a trifle exaggerated, but I'm all for it, naturally. In fact, I'm a member of NOW. I've been from the beginning.
Do you see it as being very different from the movement of the teens?
Well, I think it's much more to begin with, it has a much better background atmosphere. People are much more receptive than they used to be. It used to be just a grinding fight, and male chauvinism was universal. In fact, there was even a lot of female male chauvinism. I'm perfectly happy, and Nora didn't bang the door and all that. But I don't think that there's much difference, except that this is a much more permissive age, and people talk about things that they never used to talk about. I said to a young man the other day, who was giving me his very, very adolescent opinions on things, and finally I said, "You think you people invented sex? We did all the things you talk about, but we just didn't talk about them."
But do you think that the current women's movement has a...
I think
it has
a lunatic fringe, as every movement has, but on the whole, I think it's a good, solid, useful movement, and I certainly hope it's not going to attenuate or die out. So I'm always afraid of with every movement, you get that first enthusiasm, then you get a few things, and then you get tired. Mm-hmm. That's true of every political movement.
Do you think that the current movement is more political generally than the earlier
one?
Oh,
much more, yes. Well, because there's much more opportunity to be. What could we do? All we could do was talk. But they can actually get political blocks and influence elections. All that sort of thing that we were powerless about.
What happened to feminists after the early movement died? Did you feel an extreme kind of isolation, for instance?
Well, I don't know what you mean by the early movement. The early movement was back in 1845, and I wouldn't know.
I mean, I view that as part of a continuous one, actually.
Well, no, I don't. I think it was... I suppose individual instances, which caught my attention, I would feel that we have been let down, but I don't remember any particular. I always realized there's a great deal still to be done, and that we had to keep on doing it. I still don't know why this sudden recrudescence in the recent years. I mean, there was no one event, unless it was the fact that of the two big wars and the women for the first time did things they'd never done before and didn't want to give them up.
Well, I also do think that the involvement of women in radical politics and discovering that they were being treated rather poorly has a great deal of...
As far as I know, every political radical I've ever heard of, no matter what he was, socialist, anarchist, communist, or anything, has always been feminism was taken for granted. I don't think there's ever been any sex discrimination in any such movement.
But do you think that actually their feminism in reality was...
I don't think it was the most important thing to them. But if you'd asked them, they would all have said yes, they agreed. But very few of them would do anything in that particular line. They had plenty of other things that they were fighting about.
But within the movements, how do they treat the women, for instance?
Well, I'll tell you, that varied according to the situation. I mean, I've known, some of these communes now, you know, the girls apparently end up in the kitchen. And that would be true of there's always a tendency in any group that if there's domestic work to be done, where's the woman to do it? If you call to their attention, then they'd be embarrassed and they'd wash the dishes. But in general, the idea was that women's work is never done and is subservient to men's work, which is important.
Well, do you think that the women themselves in the radical movements in the early days accepted that idea too?
Well, you can't answer that yes or no. Some of them didn't, some of them didn't. Some of them flatly refused to be relegated to the sidelines. And then, of course, you must know people like Emma Goldman, for instance, were leaders in their particular group. And I can't imagine Emma's retiring from public life to wash the dishes. But...
Well, in fact, that was always one of the things that angered her about her relationship with I think his name was Brady.
Even Berkman.
No,
you know. Anyway, I wouldn't, if I'd been a man, I don't think I'd have wanted to marry Anna. She was a very aggressive person. And as far as I knew both Reitman and Berkman, and they were, they knuckled under and did as they were told. They were very respectful of her.
What did you think of Reitman? Because Elizabeth Gurley...
Reitman was a neurotic of the first water. When my husband was editor of the socialist paper in Everett, Washington, he had two debates with Emma, and Ben Reitman was then managing her lectures. And one day, Maynard went into his office and found Ben there, and in tears, and he said, "What's the matter?" And Ben said, "I'm so tired, I want to go home, I want my mother." He was a doctor, too.
Well, was he? I've heard that it's questionable if he actually was.
Yes, I think.
Because Elizabeth Gurley Flynn has said some very nasty things about him. She thought he was quite a fool.
Well, he was a softy, as they used to call him. He was a weakling. And as a matter of fact, I think in later years he withdrew completely from the radical movement and became just lived a very quiet, respectable, and observable life somewhere back. He lived, came from somewhere in the middle west side of Chicago, I think.
Do you feel that there was a difference, for instance, between the role of women who were active in the IWW as compared to, say, the other people?
There were very few women in the IWW because the IWW organized the mass industries and not the mass industries in which there were many women. I mean, they started with the agricultural workers and the seamen and people of that sort. But I'd known several women in the IWW, and they always had perfect equality with the other people.
Because it seems as if...
They never were very active, I mean...
Oh.
None of them were... In the big trial in 1918, there were no women.
In the Chicago trial?
They were not the leaders, but there were great. There were some members, and they were members on exactly the same basis as the men. But of course, it's a lot harder. Most of those were itinerant workers, and they went around the country in boxcars, and though there were women who did that too, there were never nearly so many. And all of the agricultural, the farm workers now are almost as many women as men. In those days, they weren't. In fact, I can't think of any that I knew then that worked on, you know, picking, going from farm to farm.
How about in the free speech fights, for instance, during the wobbly free speech fights? And when they would come into a town like into Fresno or San Diego, were there women coming in with them on those free speech fights?
I should say yes, in general. Of course, most of the women I knew in the IWW were the wives or girlfriends of men, and that's how they got in. There was one girl I knew who worked in a factory in Los Angeles who had joined her own accord. But you see, when you joined the IWW, you were put into it was divided into categories of industry. And if it was an industry, if there were no women, what would you do? Where would you belong? I'll never forget when I was finally persuaded it was a good idea to join. I belonged for about a year, and they didn't know what to do with me. I think I told you I was working for a big oil company, editing house workers, so I put the oil. Of course, it was very dangerous in those days to belong to the IWW. This was the time of World War I. You were getting up to 20 years if they caught you.
Now, did your husband belong? He never belonged, did he?
No, he was from 1960 to 1922, he was very prominent in the Socialist Party. And after that, he never... I think... I have a vague memory that once as a protest, he voted for Foster. But neither of us ever joined the Communist Party, and after we left the Socialist Party, we never belonged to anything.
So his, after his early involvement with the Socialist Party, he left the Socialist Party totally then? Yeah. After that very early involvement with Debs, he then left the Socialist Party completely?
Well, as far as he was concerned, from 1922, when he had his first heart attack, he was not well enough to do very much, except it was enough to be going around lecturing and doing all the writing and editing he was doing. And then, of course, from 1924 to 1932, we were absolutely absorbed in the anti-evolution fight. And that took up all the energy either of us had.
Well, so both of you were actively involved in that?
Well, Mary founded it and we just...
Right, but you also were...
We were in the same position you are. We never could get any money. We were incorporated as a non-profit corporation, and the dues were very low. I think it was $3 a year and 25 life membership. And we were very, very select. We had practically every well-known scientist in the country, but we didn't have an awful lot of them. And we did have a few people who just joined because they believed, but in general. And we had a secretary who was supposed to do all the office work. And finally, his salary got so far in arrears that he had to get a job somewhere. So I did it from that time on. Lost my job.
So you were involved, you were working with that and with the Federated Press?
Yes.
And working on a regular
And doing
job.
A lot of freelance writing and for magazines and all. And in fact, published my first book at that time. So I had plenty to do.
And what were you able to live on then? Was from your speaking and writing?
At that time? Mm-hmm. Well, you see, after I lost my job as an insurance adjuster, then I worked for, I guess, about 6 months as secretary of the president of a big piano company here. And then I worked 2 years as all summer in a cramming school when the office manager went on vacation. And aside from that, except during the war when I had a public relations job, and I never, World War II, I haven't ever had any 9-to-5 job.
So you, just as needed, you would try and...
And so that, and for the past 30 years, I've earned my sufficient living as a freelance writer.
Well, was the Anti-Evolution League, was that in response to the Scopes trial that you began the group? That you began the Evolution League?
Well, was because when one state after another began getting these bills in, and it was very much exercised well. After all, he'd been writing and speaking on evolution, and we were both working for Hall of Injurious, you know. He was doing all these science little blue books for him. And he said, somebody's got to fight this thing. And he wrote to the American Association for the Advancement of Science and to scientific and scholarly organization you could think of, and they all answered that yes, that somebody must do it, but they couldn't. It wasn't their line. So finally, in despair, when he was giving a long series of lectures up here, way up Market Street somewhere, and at the end of one of them, he outlined the situation at the time and suggested that we start right where we were, and that night we collected $11 and 19 members, and that was the beginning. That paid the first printing.
And what year was that, 1924?
When was the Scopes trial? Yes, that was 1924.
Was it immediately after the Scopes trial?
Oh, no, it was before the Scopes trial. We had most of the witnesses for Scopes were our members, but we didn't have money enough for it would take a definite part in it, but what we did was work through the members in each state that was threatened and have people go up to the legislature and all that.
So it was sort of a lobbying group, in other words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, people would suggest all kinds of things we could do, all of which would cost a lot of money we didn't have.
And did you go on speaking tours for it then?
Yes, but we organized branches in Los Angeles and San Diego and Sacramento, and then we got we'd take organizing trips. Sometimes I went along, sometimes I didn't. And Then we had other branches that would run their correspondence in the Middle West and the East. It was always a national organization, even though it started right here with 19 members.
The first
printing, I think, that we used, we wrote to the professors of biology and zoology and all the leading colleges, and nearly all of them joined. And then we had our first board of directors who were all of them very well-known scientists.
Who did that include, that first board?
Well, I can't tell you, we were about 30 of them. I can't tell you all of them. Luther Burbank was one, I know. David Starr Jordan was one. And they were all, what was his name, that geologist at Yale. I've forgotten his name. And they were practically all the well-known scientists. In fact, we almost came a cropper because we quite innocently had invited an astronomer who was not well thought of by his associates. And we got a plague of letters saying that if so-and-so is on the board, I don't want to be on it. So finally, there was nothing to do but appeal to the man. He was up here at the Vallejo in the Naval Depot there. And we just had it right and told him the truth, and he very kindly resigned so we could keep the others. We killed the whole organization. I've forgotten now what this thing was. His name was C, T-J-J-C, Thomas Jefferson Jackson C. But I've forgotten what the fight was about, but he was considered something lower than the low, and they weren't having him.
How many members did you ultimately have?
I can't remember now. See, all of those papers now have gone up to the University of Oregon. That young man came down and took all of men's papers up with him. And they'll be in the library there. But we had, I should say, something like 1,000 members. And not all scientists, anybody who wanted to join could join. I know there was an old man in Nevada who hadn't any money, and he used to send us rabbits he'd kill to the office, and once he someone had arrived on a Saturday, we weren't there, we got in on Monday, the place was horrible, it was like a grave. And there was an old man in Georgia who was a Spanish war veteran, and who wrote us that sometimes they paid him $5 for somebody to sleep in his bed while he slept on the floor, and he sent us the $5, which was very touching. I mean, people like that, you know, who were absolutely devoted, you couldn't possibly let them down.
Now, how long did the League last?
Until 1932, and then his health got so bad that he couldn't go on with it. We just had to let it go. And by that time, it was long after the Scopes Trum, the thing was over. It just came up again in California. I've got managed book history of the thing just stuck with this recent California stuff. Oh, I wrote about it in the Nation and New Republic. All those things go to the University of Oregon, all my tear sheets in that line. Yes, well, about twice a year I'd have an article on either on the old situation or summing up the last 6 months and that sort of thing.
Did the organization have a regular newsletter of any kind?
Yeah. At that time, I was writing a great deal anyway for both those magazines. I haven't for years. Women had at one time been active also in the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. People like Joan London, Jack London's daughter. And of course, when Roosevelt made Frances Perkins a member of the cabinet, that was a high point in a long fight. I think she was the first woman cabinet member.
Right. One of two we've had.
Yeah.
Did you go to the founding convention of the CIO as a reporter?
Oh, yeah. When I think the convention that organized CIO was here. I guess I covered that. I also covered the time that was the time I came back early from lunch. It was always held up at the Civic Auditorium. And Nobody was in the whole building except John L. Lewis. And he was striding up and down talking to himself. And I just stood discreetly in the shadows and heard him saying, "We disaffiliate, we disaffiliate." Of course, I covered AFL conventions too, and in fact, all labor conventions, besides the Mooney, all the Mooney Billings hearings and all the Bridges hearings.
How did you feel about the formation of the CIO in terms of what that would mean for the labor movement?
Well, as far as I know that, as I said before, and that's where there was always a resolution and the full equality for women, but I don't think there was any particular interest. But women were in the CIO exactly the same. There's one thing that so many of the AFL unions never took women in, but there was no CIO union which didn't. So I think there were probably some, like the auto workers, that didn't have many women. And when the newspaper guild was established, it first belonged to the AFL, and I remember very clearly the election at which we voted to join the CIO.
Oh. So it changed affiliation
actually. Yeah. So we just got out of one and got into the other. Until they sold us down the river and combined them again. Of course, that means that the AFL has won because there's very little trace left of the old CIO.
Did you cover that convention?
Oh, yes, I covered that. Yes.
When they merged too?
I also covered the first meeting of the United Nations here and the 20-year reunion, whatever you call it, 20-year memorial.
What did you cover those for?
For the Federated Press.
For the Federated Press.
Yes, it was 1945, you see. Right after Roosevelt died and Truman.
And how about the 20th memorial meeting? How about the 20th anniversary meeting? Who did you cover that for?
Well, it would be 1965. But at that time, it was the 10 year. It was 1955, and I was still working. Yeah, it was 10 years. Because I know I came to went to it. Found Tom Mooney's sister, Emma, in the acting as a waitress in the canteen. She was a waitress by profession, but I hadn't seen her for years. I went in to get lunch or something, and suddenly Anna burst out with her arms around me. I guess that was after Tom was dead. She was the last of the family down there, too.
Well, you were always on the periphery of all of these activities.
Well, things interlocked. You knew people one way or another. See, I never was on the Mooney Defense Committee, but I knew everybody on it very well and covered that. And that also I wrote about both the Nation and the Republic regularly. And then, of course, I wrote a book at Tom's request. I went up every week to San Quentin.
Tell me about that.
So I got to know all of that family very well indeed. There, the old lady, his mother, one of the hearings, breathing, sitting right behind me and breathing down my neck and saying, "Oh God, that's a lie. Oh God, that's a lie." And the day I sailed for Hawaii in 1935, she had just died and her funeral was being held at the Civic Auditorium. It was all draped in black. I remember as I passed on the way to the ship. And they're all gone now, since Billings died.
Yes.
I saw Warren up just before he died. He used to come and see me all the time from San Jose.
He became a watchmaker, didn't he?
Yeah. Yes. He learned watchmaking in Folsom. And he had a place of his own up in the Grand Building at 7th and Market for years. Then after he retired, he worked sort of part-time for a jeweler on Maiden Lane. That's when he used to come to see me after. He worked 2 days a week or so. He had emphysema and he couldn't do very much after he was 70 or so.
Hmm.
And his wife died of cancer a year before he did, and he just sort of went to pieces.
In all of your writing, you've always used the Miriam Allen DeFort, haven't
you? I've always written under my maiden name.
And when you were writing socialist, did you write for the socialist papers too?
Yeah, I was always, that's the only thing I've ever written under, except once when I was twice in an anthology, and so the other one was by M.A. Shipley. I think occasionally, in my first marriage, I wrote under the name of Collier when I had some reason that I didn't want to know who was writing it. But that's, as far as my actual career goes, I've always written under my maiden name. And I had an answer too, because I was bonded to the insurance company under my first married name, and there was no sense in changing it. I never knew what I was going to be called. Years and years later, I was waiting for a bus, and somebody said, "Well, Mrs. Collier." I hadn't heard that for at least 50 years. It was a girl who had been our file clerk. She also had been married and was a widow.
That must be a funny experience. I just want to go back now and ask you a couple of questions about the suffrage. That picture that you sent to the Women's History Library in Berkeley, I did see it once.
Yeah, they have
that. That was in Philadelphia, the parade, wasn't it?
Yeah, as I remember, one is of the staff at the Philadelphia headquarters. I think that must be in 1910 or so. And then there's one that, I don't know, it's 1907, something like that, of the Philadelphia contingent of the National Parade in New York.
Now, you didn't go to those parades?
Yes, I'm holding on to the banner from one side of it.
How old would you have been then?
Well, I don't remember just which year it was. In 1907, I was already working on the paper. I would have been 19 years old.
Did you go on your own, though?
Yeah.
I mean, your mother didn't also go to any...
Oh, no. My mother, by that time, was very deaf and not very strong. She had to give up practicing medicine because she was so deaf. And she never... She was always rather frail. She never marched in parade or anything like that. I was the representative of the family. My father was all for woman suffrage, but he wasn't. He would have been ashamed, embarrassed to have been. They usually were about, out of several hundred women in a parade, there would be a little contingent of maybe half a dozen men. And they always looked sort of beaten to their wives and said, "You go or else."
So that 1907 picture...
I think it is. I can't remember exactly, but the date's on it anyway.
Okay. And that was actually in New York, though.
What they did was, I don't know how far it went. I mean, I don't know how far south or how far north, but I know that all the Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, we had the parade in New York. And I don't remember whether it was Labor Day or what the occasion was. It was an annual thing. I think that was the parade, that was the time in that picture when the whole parade was led by Inez Milholland. It was a beautiful woman, and she was dressed in armor and mounted on a white horse.
I always thought that might have been later.
I remember that. I was at that parade too, but I don't remember just when it was. I know she died of pernicious anemia because they didn't have a cure for it then. Now they should have been recovered.
Now, so you would go to the parade every year?
No, as long as I lived in the East, yes. But we would send over quite a lot. Every city would have its own contingent with a banner in front, giving our locale. And I think this picture was taken by some news photographer when we were forming before we started to march.
Were there speeches at the end of the parade, or was it just a very quiet parade with no speeches?
Well, we got a lot of jeering from the sidelines, so we didn't do anything. There never was any violence, if that's what you mean.
Was there any...
Nobody threw anything or anything like that. They just laughed and made fun of us. Just as when we used to pass around the petitions after soapbox talk, a lot of people would sign with phony names, like Luke McLuke. Chip the blood and that kind of thing.
Were there speeches at the end of the parade?
I don't remember.
Was there any sort of rally or anything?
I think probably, but I don't remember. For one thing, we weren't at the head of the parade. We were somewhere way back. All New York went first. And of course, New York was always the largest contingent.
Do you remember parades in Philadelphia itself?
Yeah,
too?
Well, I don't remember whether we must have had parades, but if we had, I'd have been in them, and I don't remember any, but there must have been some, and I've just forgotten.
When you mentioned before, I had the impression that maybe you, did you write any of the literature of that group in Philadelphia?
I doubt it very much. It was, for one thing, I left Philadelphia in 1911, and then I came back for a year. I did graduate work in Pennsylvania, and then went. I never lived in Philadelphia after 1912. And before that, I was just a youthful kid around the office. All I did was fold things and stuff them in envelopes and that kind of thing. Run errands to the post office and all.
But from that very early involvement, you remained continuously involved until you left.
Oh, yeah, I should say that. Yeah, from that time on, I always had some kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know all these people, you see, and they would know other people.
But then after the soapboxing experiences in Boston, that was really the end of the specific suffrage activity.
Well, I also soapboxed in Spokane, Washington in 1917. I think that's the last time I spoke on the street.
Now, that was for Mooney, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the soapboxing...
No, I think the whole idea of soapboxing died down. I never heard of it in recent years.
Except in New York, you see it.
Yeah, probably.
No. But after that soapboxing, that was sort of the end of your suffrage and activity.
Well, in San Diego, I never did very much because I was a public stenographer and very busy, and we lived in Coronado, and I had a commute. In Los Angeles, I got to know the Menides anarchists, and we more or less were active then, though I never was one of them. And when I went back to Baltimore for a year and a half, that's where I met Maynard. He was editing the socialist paper. But I was then a member in good standing at IWW. And we had some very hot political fights on the value of political action versus industrial action. But I never had, there I was editing a house organ for a big olive oil company, and then got in with a Maryland casualty company in the